हरि ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे.
Okay, page 39, chapter 87, canto 10. Actually, ecstatic samadhi, or absorption in the Supreme Personality of Godhead, can be achieved by constant engagement in His service. And this constant engagement in devotional service can be performed only when one works under the direction of a bona fide spiritual master. Right? Because it's not that it's by our own determination and our own material qualities that we're becoming good at this. It's because of Krishna's mercy. Right? So that one can focus on devotional service, be steady in devotional service because of Krishna's mercy. Why do we get the mercy? Because of the mercy of the spiritual master. So without approach under working under the direction of the bona fide spiritual master, you can't come to this point of ecstatic samadhi. It's just not going to happen. The Vedas therefore instruct that in order to know the science of devotional service, one has to submit himself unto the bona fide spiritual master. The bona fide spiritual master is he who knows the science of devotional service in disciplic succession. The disciplic succession is called Shrotriya. The prime symptom of one who has become a spiritual master in disciplic succession is that he is 100% fixed in bhakti yoga. Sometimes people neglect to accept a spiritual master, and instead they endeavor for self-realization by mystic yoga practice. But there are many instances of failure, even by great yogis like Vishwamitra. Arjuna said in the Bhagavad Gita that controlling the mind is as impractical as stopping the blowing of a hurricane. Sometimes the mind is compared to a maddened elephant. Without following the direction of a spiritual master, one cannot control the mind and the senses. In other words, if one practices yoga mysticism and does not accept a bona fide spiritual master, he will surely fail. He will simply waste his valuable time, right? Because you can go through the mechanics and you may get good at balancing the, you know, the asana itself, the muscles that are being used and all that, the pranayama that is there, the mental state that you're using, trying to balance all that, you may become quite good at that. But the point is it doesn't mean you'll please Krishna. That's only going to come in connection with the spiritual master. The Vedic injunction is that no one can have full knowledge without being under the guidance of an acharya. Because full knowledge means knowing Krishna. Acharya van purusho veda. One who's accepted an acharya knows what is what. The absolute truth cannot be understood by arguments. Right? So it's not just because you study, you know technical things, others come up with ideas, you can defeat that. That's not what it's about. One who's attained the perfect brahminical stage naturally becomes renounced. He does not strive for material gain because by spiritual knowledge he's come to the conclusion in this world there is no insufficiency. Right? Krishna's running the whole place, there's plenty. So if Krishna wants to give you, you'll have it. And if Krishna doesn't, it doesn't matter what you do, you won't get it. Therefore, we do devotional service, which means if we're in family, then we perform our occupational duties. And then in the performance of that, whatever is required, we'll get. And if we don't get, we're not supposed to. Yes?
So the guidance, nowadays we have a general guidance of the acharya. And then specific, it's very individual. Some devotees get it, some don't. Some gurus give it, some don't. And so what would be the difference? You know, Because the guidance, like say, for example, in the story of Gopkumar, he saw his guru several times in his life, and it wasn't...
But is it about the... it's not about Vapu, it's about Vani.
Yeah.
Because Vani is eternal. You always can take advantage of Vani. Vapu, then, it may be appreciated, maybe not, because you might get that association, you may not, because you see he got... You know, when he was in Braj, then he got again when he was at Puri, and then he got again, I think, after he got back from Vaikuntha. Right? And then he got again in Goloka. Yeah, so the whole idea is that instruction always functions. So when we get the instruction from the Acharyas, It's not that we're getting specific instruction. We're getting relevant instruction. Because specific instruction has already been given by the Acharyas. But relevant means that it makes it those instructions relevant for us. Right? So it's not that some new system or some new angler that is there. It's a matter of making what the Acharyas have given, you know, through Srila Prabhupada, you know, accessible for us. Right? So it's not about that constant association, that emotional, that all these things, that has nothing to do with it. It's about the instruction that's there and being inspired to do that. So Krishna's in the heart, he's the guru, Adi Guru. And the guru, he comes outside as the you know, guru himself, Siksha and Diksha Guru. So if we're trying to follow the order of guru, then Krishna being pleased with that, then that process, that path will be cleared. Right? We're taking that instruction we have, we try to follow it, and it works. Because Krishna is arranging. So it's not that physical proximity, that constant interaction, and that special instruction. You know, it's just like, you know, you've told so many things like that, and then they'll go, oh, but, you know, what's some special instruction? You know, I've heard that, I mean, like a million times. They want something that's different, no one else has, you know. Yes, you know, you get a bucket. Oh, yes. And then you turn it upside down. Oh. And then you stand on your head on top of that. Wow. Without using your hands. Okay. And then you take your finger and move it up and down on your lips while chanting Hare Krishna, you know. And ideally, if you can, you slowly rotate on your head on top of the bucket. And so I'd probably recommend a good, very good quality plastic bucket, because the other ones will be hard. And the other way, this will go in a little bit and make it easier. Or if you know some kid that has those, you know, those funny little things that you spin like this.
Spinner.
The spinner, yeah. Put one of those on there, then stand on it. Then it can be very easily. Then you can just, yeah, a little bit of move, but yeah, it'll...
It has this thing that
you can... Yeah, yeah. You know, so what is it looking for? No, you chant Hare Krishna, and these are the methods, and this is how you can apply it in your life. Then through manana, then someone applies it. And because of that, then they advance very nicely. So the whole point is that when you take the order of the spiritual master and try to apply it in all situations in your life, that's where you start to get the benefits. So even if it's just one line, that's all that's necessary. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't require these volumes of instruction are there, but you just take any one of them and apply it, and it will work. You know, it's like there's devotees who just take book distribution. And that's all they do. Someone else does some other, you know, college preaching. Someone else does deity worship. Someone else does management. And then they take those instructions there and apply those in their life. And they become Krishna conscious. So that the lack of proximity of the guru is not actually the problem. Because instruction are always there. Super soul is always there. Right? And the other Vaishnavas are there. So then, taking advantage of that, that's what you're doing. And so associated with the guru is simply how to make the instructions of Prabhupada relevant in our life. Does that make sense?
Just clarify on the relevance point. Is it connected with time? if like relevant for somebody, it might be relevant, but for me, it's not relevant yet.
Yes, so that's why then that's what the Vaishnavas are doing. They're making the instructions of the founder Acharya relevant for you. But relevant for you means how you can be Krishna conscious. That's the relevance. It's not about, you know, well, you know, you want that emotional time or that, you know, quality time with the spiritual man. None of that kind of stuff. I mean, that's become very popular nowadays, but that's not actually what makes it work. You know, it's about when the opportunity is there, you take advantage and the instructions are there and it all works nicely. But it's not that, well, you know, I haven't seen my guru for, you know, 2 years, so, you know, like, no. Because the instructions are still with you right now. That is the spiritual master. And Paramatma is with you now. You know, it's like, when did Srila Prabhupada get the instruction to go preach in the West? Yeah, so 1922. Right? And so then he got initiated in 33. And then he started the BTG in 44. Right? So in 55, and I think that's when he took sannyas and all that, and then he put together the Bhagavatam when that's ready, then he went to America in 66, or started ISKCON in 66. Right? So the whole point is that he's hearing that instruction in 22, but it's not until 66 that it's, you know, been able to be applied in its form that he found. Because before that, it's like he's trying to set up something to, you know, create this body of devotees who then can go and preach and do all that. That didn't work. You know, tried to work with his god brothers. That didn't work. You know, so all these things started the BTG. That worked. He wrote his books. That worked. And then, you know, his god brothers had originally gone to London, because that was at that time, you know, the center of, you know, the British Empire was very big, very, so going to London was very important. But then he found this, there was an opportunity to go to America. You know, and also at that time America was a bit more prominent than London. And so then, you know, what was happening there was happening around the world, you know, like that. So he went there. And then, you know, how he got there, you know, so he gets there, they stop at Boston, then they get to New York, then he goes to upstate New York, then he comes back down to New York. Is that, you know, so it's just, he has that instruction to preach, so then he's just trying to find where that applies, how to make it work practically. So that one instruction, that lasts for a lifetime. So that's why you see many times, you know, in the histories, someone has a very short interaction with their spiritual master and then never sees them again the rest of their life. So like someone like Narad Muni, Magrari the Hunter, we don't hear Narad Muni drops in, you know, every weekend or something, you know, comes for the Sunday program or something. You know, who knows if you ever saw him again. But the point is that principle is there. Or, you know, that the... What was that? Yeah, like that. I mean, then she just, those 3 days of hearing the chanting and everything like that. And then he gave some, when she did surrender, he gave some instructions. And that's all he gave. And then from there, she just continued on. Benapol. I was trying to think of the place. Right? Like that. So, you see is that's what's required, that connection. And then you take that, you contemplate it, you try to make it work. And then that's the point. So that's what's unique there. While you see others who had gone before Prabhupada to the West, they weren't looking at as much that aspect. You know, they went, they established themselves, they, you know, nice things were happening, but I think they had to send money from India to maintain them in London. I don't think they were, you know, making it themselves. It would probably went 40 rupees, then, you know, he had to take care of himself. Right? So, it's just a matter of seeing and practically applying. So, he started also in the same place like those in London did. You know, the more aristocratic, you know, elite kind of intellectual, you know, people like that, which is a natural place to start. If you can catch them, they control everything. But instead of it convincing them, it just made it interesting and intriguing and stuff like that, but they weren't taking it seriously. So then he would change how he dressed, how he'd eat, how he'd do everything, trying to fit in with them rather than the other way around. So Prabhupada, when he went to America, he started in that, the uptown, you know, yoga studios and all that. That's all the rich ladies and all the rich people, because they have nothing else to do. They're already rich. But he could see is that they were pleasant, they'd listen and all that, but they weren't that serious. They weren't actually going to dedicate their lives, which they weren't doing in London. Right? And so then Krishna arranged, and, you know, things that worked out. He ended up down on, someone gave him an offer to the Lower East Side. So he went there. And there he found, now here's where some people are trying to understand something. Right? So he's simply taking that instruction and trying to get them to hear it. And so those who are willing to hear, that's where he went. Because otherwise, by the other methods, well, that's not prestigious, and it's not this and that. And yes, but the point is they're hearing, because that's the instruction. You know, because the instruction wasn't go hang out with aristocratic people in the western cities and, you know, kind of, you know, act in such a way that they find you not an annoyance, you know, or maybe even a novelty. So they, you know, you're interesting to have around. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, but it was to give them this message. And so the only ones who would take the message were the ones on the Lower East Side. And then those guys, then they opened San Francisco, they opened L.A., they opened then Santa Fe and Toronto and like this. They went to London, they went to Germany. You know, he brought them to India. And then from there, then it went back up again. Is that?
Yeah.
So that kind of thing is if they can take that and apply that, because you're trying to follow the order of Guru, Krishna being pleased, he'll show you how to do it. But we have to be surrendered to that. If we have some other position and other attitude, then it won't work so well. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, one who's attained the perfect brahminical stage naturally becomes renounced because nothing's for him. It doesn't mean he doesn't have more stuff. Sudama Brahman was a perfect Brahman, renounced Brahman. He had more opulence than Indra. Of course, that's more of a one-off case. You know, it's not a standard thing. But the point is that renounced doesn't mean he has nothing. Renounced means nothing's for him. So those things that are for you that aren't so important in Krishna consciousness, those are given up. Anything that's useful in Krishna consciousness, that's kept. He does not strive for material gain because by spiritual knowledge, you come to the conclusion that in this world, there's no insufficiency. Right? Krishna is providing, and so therefore, whatever you deserve, you'll get. And you don't strive for material gain because you just perform your duties to please Krishna, and whatever you're supposed to get, you'll get anyway. Everything is sufficiently provided by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A real Brahman, therefore, does not endeavor for material perfection. Right? It's just what's useful in Krishna's service. Rather, he approaches a bona fide spiritual master to accept orders from him. The spiritual master's qualification is that he is Brahmanishta, which means that he has given up all other activities and has dedicated his life to working only for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. When a bona fide student approaches a bona fide spiritual master, he submissively prays to the spiritual master. My dear Lord, kindly accept me as your student and train me in such a way that I will be able to give up all other processes of self-realization and simply engage in Krishna consciousness, devotional service. So that's what we're trying to gain from the spiritual master. Other things you can get from so many places, you know, especially nowadays, you know, the Google Guru, he can teach you so many things if you want. Like that. Okay. So then from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. In this way, the Shrutis have spoken about pure bhakti of the Vaishnavas, unmixed with yoga or other processes. Now they establish that such bhakti should be devoid of other desires. Sardar Darshani 10:87-34. The Shrutis continue. To those persons who take shelter of you, you reveal yourself as the super soul, the embodiment of all transcendental pleasure. What further use have such devotees for their servants, children or bodies, their wives, money or houses, their land, good health or conveyances? And for those who fail to appreciate the truth about you and go on pursuing the pleasures of sex, what could there be in this entire world? A place inherently doomed to destruction and devoid of significance that could give them real happiness. So we've talked about pure devotional service. Therefore, what's the need of anything unless there's a connection to Krishna? Right? So if you see that connection, it's there. Like Kardama Muni, he saw a connection between himself as a brahmachari trying to get to the point where he's fully dedicated to the Lord. And he saw, due to his own desires, that going through the Grihastha ashram would be suitable. And so he did that. But for him, that was the process of becoming Krishna conscious. So we need to be able to see all these things in connection with Krishna. They can't be because they're gain, they're prestige, they're all these other things. It has to be simply because of its usefulness in Krishna's service. And if it's not, then what's the point of them? So if they're not helping in devotional service, what's the point? Right? Srila Prabhupada writes in Krishna book, the devotee engaged by the direction of the spiritual master in the transcendental loving service of the Lord contemplates as follows. My dear Lord, you are the reservoir of pleasure. Since you are present, what is the use of the transient pleasure derived from society, friendship, and love? Persons unaware of the supreme reservoir of pleasure falsely engage in deriving pleasure from sense gratification. But this is transient and illusory, right? Sense gratification doesn't mean engaging the senses. Sense gratification means the senses are engaged without a connection to Krishna. Right? So that's why bhakti already includes the engagement of the senses and whatever you're looking for. But we're always seeing that it connects to Krishna. In this connection, Vidyapati, a great Vaishnav devotee and poet, says, quote, my dear Lord, undoubtedly there is some pleasure in the midst of society, friendship, and love, although it is materially conceived. But such pleasure cannot satisfy my heart, which is like a desert, right? Because it's like a drop. Right? In a desert, there is need of an ocean of water. But if only a drop of water is poured on the desert, what is the value of such water? Yeah, so we're saying, yes, there is one drop. Similarly, our material hearts are full of multi-desires which cannot be fulfilled by materialistic society, friendship, and love. When our hearts begin to derive pleasure from the supreme reservoir of pleasure, then we can be satisfied. That transcendental satisfaction is possible only in devotional service, in full Krishna consciousness. Does that make sense? So that's the idea, is that the motive is not society, friendship, and love. The motive is pleasing Krishna. You may be working within society, friendship, and love, but it's not about that. It's about pleasing Krishna. That's then how it is. Yeah? The Shrutis continue. Sages free from false pride live on this earth by frequenting the sacred pilgrimage sites and those places where the Supreme Lord displayed his pastimes. Because such devotees keep your lotus feet within their hearts, the water that washes their feet destroys all sins. Anyone who even once turns his mind towards you, the ever-blissful soul of all existence, no longer dedicates himself to serving family life at home, which simply robs a man of his good qualities. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur elaborates. Because the Vaishnavas take your lotus feet in their heart, their foot water cuts off all sins. It goes without saying that such persons never worship servants, sons, body, women, and house. When even those persons who just once fixed their mind on your eternally blissful form do not worship houses which steal away the intelligence, steadiness, tolerance, and other good qualities of men. Because it can't be about these things. You may be engaged in that environment because there must be some time, some place that you're functioning in. So according to the time, and according to your nature, like that, then you're going to apply yourself in Krishna consciousness. Right? So, there's no worship of these, there's engaging. Because worship means is that there's a goal you want to get from them. But for us, there's no goal we want to get from them. We're just engaging them in the goal of being Krishna conscious. Srila Prabhupada writes in Krishna book, the personified Vedas continue, "Dear Lord, you are Satchidananda Vigraha, the ever-blissful form of knowledge, and because the living entities are parts and parcels of your personality, their natural state of existence is to be fully conscious of you. In this material world, anyone who has developed such Krishna consciousness is no longer interested in the materialistic way of life. A Krishna conscious being becomes uninterested in family life, where there is some concession for sense enjoyment." Right? In other words, family life here, meaning that it's about what emotions, feelings, and, you know, sensual engagement that one's getting from it, that's why you're doing it. Rather than you're involved in family life, and in that you're seeing how to connect everything to Krishna. The same experiences may be there, but it's not about those experiences. It's just like the devotee is eating prasad, honoring prasad, so he's worshipping prasad. He's not worshipping food. Right? Gourmets worship food, or gourmands worship food. Right? But he's not, because it's about the taste they'll get from it. They're worshipping prasad, Krishna. And so in that, you'll get the same taste. In fact, it's better. When Krishna tastes this, it's better than when he did. So, the perfection of human life is based on knowledge and renunciation. But it is very difficult to attempt to reach the stage of knowledge and renunciation while in family life. Krishna conscious persons therefore take shelter of the association of devotees or sanctified places of pilgrimage. Such persons are aware of the relationship between the supersoul and the individual living entities, and they are never in the bodily concept of life, because they always carry you in full Krishna consciousness within their hearts. They are so purified that any place they go becomes a holy place of pilgrimage. And the water which washes their feet is able to deliver any sinful persons loitering within this material world. Right, so it says here, so one's not to reach the stage of knowledge and renunciation, then they take shelter of the association of devotees. That's what you're doing. Right? It didn't say that you leave family life. It meant you associate with devotees. Then it's about devotional service. Right? Because family life means it's all about social and all these kind of things, not based on Krishna consciousness. But when it's based on Krishna consciousness, then it takes on the association of devotees. But Prahlad Maharaj was asked by his atheistic father to describe something very good which he had learned. He replied to his father, quote, "For a materialistic person who is always full of anxieties due to being engaged in temporary and relative truths, the best course is to give up the blind well of family life and go to the forest to take shelter of the Supreme Lord." End quote. Right? To the biggest materialist in the universe, right? Right? But he says, he speaks very pleasantly, sweetly, and everything like that. Those who are actually pure devotees are celebrated as Mahatmas, or great sages, personalities perfect in knowledge. They always think of the Supreme Lord and his lotus feet, and thus they automatically become liberated. Devotees who are always situated in that position become electrified by the inconceivable potencies of the Lord, and thus they themselves become the source of liberation for their followers and devotees. A Krishna conscious person is fully electrified spiritually, and therefore anyone who touches or takes shelter of such a pure devotee becomes similarly electrified with spiritual potencies. Such devotees are never puffed up with material opulences. Generally, the material opulences are good parentage, education, beauty, and riches. But although a devotee of the Lord may possess all four of these material opulences, he is never carried away by the pride of possessing such distinctions. Great devotees of the Lord travel all over the world from one place of pilgrimage to another, and on their way they meet many conditioned souls and deliver them by their association and distribution of transcendental knowledge. They generally reside in places like Vrindavan, Mathura, Dwarka, Jagannath Puri, and Navadvip, because only devotees assemble in such places. In this way, they give saintly association to one another, and thus advance, so that every living entity can take advantage of the association of Krishna-conscious persons. Such great devotees open temples and ashrams where Krishna's devotees assemble. By such association, people can develop more and more in Krishna consciousness. Such advancement is not possible in ordinary household life, which is devoid of Krishna consciousness, right? So that's ordinary household life. So for Krishna conscious household life means it's about associating with devotees, advancing in Krishna consciousness. The Shrutis continued. It may be proposed that this world is permanently real because it is generated from the permanent reality. But such an argument is subject to logical refutation. Sometimes, indeed, the apparent non-difference of a cause and its effect fails to prove true, and at other times the product of something real is illusory. Furthermore, this world cannot be permanently real, for it partakes of the natures of not only the absolute reality, but also the illusion disguising that reality. Actually, the visible forms of this world are just an imaginary arrangement resorted to by succession of ignorant persons in order to facilitate their material affairs. With their various meanings and implication, the learned words of your Vedas bewilder all persons whose minds have been dulled by hearing the incantations of sacrificial rituals. Bhagavad Gita 2:42-43 similarly states, men of small knowledge are very much attached to the flowery words of the Vedas, which recommend various fruitive activities for elevation to heavenly planets, resultant good birth, power, and so forth. Being desirous of sense gratification, opulent life, they say there is nothing more than this. Right? So that's the point. That's household life. But when we take up devotional life, then it doesn't matter where you're situated. One is situated in one position or another, but it's all connected to Krishna. So that's what we're trying to get at. So it's not that, oh, everything's all right. No, it's about its connection to Krishna. Oh, so we don't need anything. No, can it be engaged in Krishna's service? Oh, then we can use it however. No, it's about, you understand? So it always wants to go either just renounced, and by renunciation that's perfection, or we can engage the senses and that's perfection. No, it's about being Krishna conscious. So the renunciation is the attitude. Whether externally you see renunciation or not, that's another thing. But it's about the attitude. You're working with something, but you're not attached to it because it's for Krishna. That's renunciation. Right? In some sense. And even you're renounced, if you're attached to whatever little bit you have, then that's a problem. Right? Smaller problem, but still a problem. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur assigns verse 36 to Bhagavad Arkamrichi Mala, chapter 1, entitled Indications of Evidence, Pramana Nirdesha, which is in the Sambandha section of the Thakur's book. Srila Prabhupada writes in Krishna book, the personified Vedas continue. Dear Lord, there are two classes of transcendentalists, the impersonalists and the personalists. The opinion of the impersonalists is that this material manifestation is false, that only the absolute truth is factual. The view of the personalists, notice it says the opinion of the impersonalists and the view of the... The view of the personalists, however, is that the material world, although very temporary, is nevertheless not false but factual. Such transcendentalists have different arguments to establish the validity of their philosophies. Factually, the material world is simultaneously both truth and untruth. It is truth because everything is expansion of the supreme absolute truth, and it is untruth because the existence of the material world is temporary. It is created and it is annihilated. Because of its different conditions of existence, the cause of manifestation has no fixed position. End quote. Those who advocate acceptance of this material world as false are generally known by the maxim Brahma Satyam Jagat Mitya. They put forward the argument that everything in the material world is prepared for matter. For example, there are many things made of clay, such as earthen pots, dishes, and bowls. After their annihilation, these things may be transformed into many other material objects. But in all cases, their existence as clay continues. An earth and water jug, after being broken, may be transformed into a bowl or dish. But either as a dish, bowl, or water jug, the earth itself continues to exist. Right? So the form that it has as a jug, as a bowl, you know, as a, what is it, dish, then are temporary. But its position as earth, that continues. Right? So in the same way as that, this world is made up of Krishna's energies, and that is existing. But the forms that those energies take, that's temporary. And that's always going to be temporary.
Okay? And that's what this the statement is there, that the world cannot be permanently real because it takes also the natures of the illusion disguising the reality. This is
illusion, because we think it's eternal, it's not. Or we think it's not connected to the Lord. Or we think it's for we will get happiness from trying to enjoy it, or satisfaction. So the illusion is our mentality. But another thing it gives here, it's temporary. So that's illusion. It's not actually real, it goes away. You know, it's just like, okay, let us say you take a cloth, right? The magician holds it up, and then they move the cloth, and then something's there, then they put it, and then it goes away. So is that fact or illusion? Okay, now let's say, you know, we hold up a cloth, you know, and the other members of the family, what's happening? And you remove the cloth, and then you have your mother-in-law there. Right? That's reality. That doesn't go away. Is that make sense? So, in other words, it's illusion because it's temporary. It comes, it goes. So, from that angle, you can say the material world is illusory because of the temporary. But it's real because it's come from the absolute truth, is real. You know, just like clay is real. Then you transform it into a pot. That big pot gets that, so then it becomes something else. Then from that, it becomes a dish. You know what I'm saying? So that's one of the things that's mentioned, is that, you know, as one of things called a pot shard. When you have a big pot and it breaks and you have a piece of it, that's called a pot shard. So that's the recommended dish for renunciates. Because no one else wants it. No one's going to steal your pot shard. Yeah. But at the same time, it says they shouldn't have a broken dish. So that means the pot shard that he has shouldn't be cracked. Otherwise, you can't use it. You put anything in it, it drips all over, it gets all over your clothes, it makes everything a mess. You know what I'm saying? So that's it. It should be broken, but not broken.
The pieces that is yours shouldn't be broken.
Yes, it means the rest of it is. Yeah. But, so the point is that it's temporary. That's why it's illusion. Another angle is that because of what we think, we don't understand its eternal nature, its spiritual nature, its connection to Krishna. We think it's separate from Krishna. We think it's there for us to enjoy. That's illusion. So, one, you can look at it, is the mentality that people have. That's the illusion. And what's there, that's real. Another way is looking at it, what's there is real because of its connection to the Lord, but because it's temporary, its manifestation there, that's the unreal. So then when you put that that illusory perception on something that's temporary, then it gets even worse. Right? Does that make sense? Therefore, the forms of a water jug, bowl, or dish are false, but their existence as earth is real. This is the impersonalist version. This cause of manifestation is certainly produced from the absolute, but because its existence is temporary, it is false. The impersonalist understanding is that the absolute truth, which is always present, is the only truth. In the opinion of other transcendentalists, however, this material world being produced of the absolute truth is also truth. So, right? So we're going to take that aspect. Because when they say it's illusion, they won't even deal with it. So it's temporary, therefore it's illusion, so they won't deal with it. But the point is it's governed by Krishna's laws. Right? Being governed by these laws through his potencies, therefore you can serve Krishna through it. Therefore it's real. Does that make sense? So then the world is real, the mentality is what is illusion. The impersonalists argue that this is fallacious because it is sometimes found that matter is produced from spirit soul and sometimes that spirit soul is produced from matter. Right? That's their idea. Such philosophers push forward the argument that although cow dung is dead matter, sometimes it is found that scorpions come out of cow dung. Similarly, you know, also your foot, and you're alive, and you came out of cow dung, right? You know, so. Therefore, things produced of a certain thing are not always of the same quality as that thing, right? But the point is cow dung doesn't produce. There's an egg there, then there was a scorpion, and you know, so they only use things how much they want. On the strength of this argument, Mayavadi philosophers try to establish that although this cosmic manifestation is certainly an emanation from the absolute truth, the cosmic manifestation does not necessarily have truth in it. Right, because they don't understand how the Lord, through his energies, has done all this. So they don't know the personal. They can't actually know how creation works. And because of that, they can't actually understand what's truth and what's not.
Prabhupada tells in one lecture an example, like for Swamsha and Vibhinnamsha, it tells like Vibhinnamsha are like nails and hair.
Okay.
You can remove it.
Right.
And they are no more connected. But Swamsha are like your hands and bodily parts, which you can't remove from your.
Okay, yes, yes. And the hair, if it's touched, it connected, it's part of the body. But if it's disconnected, then it's useless.
What do they get by denying that cosmic manifestation doesn't have to be connected?
Didn't we discuss all that this morning? You asked this question this morning. According to this view, means the Mayavadis, the absolute truth Brahman should therefore be accepted as truth, whereas the cosmic manifestation, although a product of the absolute truth, cannot be taken as truth. Right? So for us is that if you don't connect it to it, then that's the illusion. It means we're an illusion, but it's still there. So the same argument that they give, yes, it is. It means that it's still earth. But the point is that earth means it's the Lord is pervading throughout everything. So there's no difference there. They're just taking it, you know, one side of the argument and not the other. In the view of the Mayavad philosopher, however, is stated in the Bhagavad Gita to be the view of the asuras or demons. The Lord says in the Bhagavad Gita, asatyam apratishtam te jagad ahur anishvaram aparaspara sambhutam kim anyat kama haitukam. Bhagavad Gita 16:8. The asura's view of this cosmic manifestation is that the whole creation is false. The asuras think that the mere interaction of matter is the source of the creation and that there is no controller or God. But actually, this is not the fact. The transcendental energies of the Lord are variegated, and because such varieties of energies have emanated from the Supreme Lord, they cannot be false. The Lord is ever-existing, and the energies are ever-existing. Some of the energy is temporary, sometimes manifested and sometimes unmanifested. But this does not mean that it is false. Right? Because so that it's manifest temporary and then not manifest, that doesn't mean it's false, because it exists. It's just what state it exists in. The example may be given that when a person is angry, he does things which are different from his normal condition of life. But the fact that the mood of anger appears and disappears does not mean that the energy of anger is false. As such, the argument of the Mayavadi philosophers that this world is false is not accepted by the Vaishnava philosophers. The Lord Himself confirms that the view that there is no supreme cause of this material manifestation, that there is no God, and that everything is only the creation of the interaction of matter, is a view of the Asuras. Right? Because they're ultimately not going to connect it back to Brahman. Because how can Brahman create? That's their problem. Right? So then the point is that he through his energies is creating. So they can't actually understand. So then if this is false, then that makes Brahman true. Right? So but the actuality is that it's manifested from Krishna through his energies, and therefore it's real. It may not be ideal, but it's real. You know, like the living entity's condition, but they're real. Right? The material world may not be your ideal place. It's temporary, but it's real. Our view of it, that's where the illusion actually is. Like we...
They don't have the aspect of energy and energetic.
No, not at all. Because then for them, that's two. And they say, no, it's only one. But then there's themselves and the Supreme, so if we're already one, then what's the endeavor to get there? Because if there's only one, there's no illusion. So if there's no illusion, there's no jiva. So they don't exist. So why are they talking? Like, if it's all a dream and there's one jiva's dreaming, tell them, yeah, that's me. You're an illusion, so just be quiet. You know, and if they say, no, I'm the one dreaming, he says, no, it can't be. It can't be dualistic. It has to be, you know, one, so I'm the one. You know, it's whatever. You can have fun spinning their heads around. The Mayavadi philosopher sometimes puts forward the argument of the snake and the rope. In the dark of evening, a curled up rope is sometimes, due to ignorance, taken for a snake. By mistaking the rope for a snake does not mean that the rope or the snake is false, right? That's their saying. It's not a snake, so it's false. Yeah, but it's actually a rope. So we're saying that. Yeah, you think the material world is there for you to enjoy and all that. That's thinking, that's the snake. No, it's a coiled rope. It's not for your enjoyment. Right? And therefore, this example used by the Mayavadis to illustrate the falsity of the material world is not valid. Because snakes exist for you to mistake the rope as a snake. Right? Otherwise, how does their example work? Right? When a thing is taken as fact but actually has no existence at all, it is called false. But if something is mistaken for something else that exists, that does not mean it is false. The Vaishnava philosopher used a very appropriate example, comparing this material world to an earthen pot. When we see an earthen pot, it does not at once disappear and turn into something else. It may be temporary, but the earthen pot is taken into use for bringing water, and we continue to see it as an earthen pot. Therefore, although the earthen pot is temporary and different from the original earth, we cannot say that it is false. Right? Otherwise, how do you bring water? We should therefore conclude that the earthen pot and the entire earth are both truths because one is the product of the other. Right? And then taking it further, then the earth is then an expansion of the Lord. The example given by the Mayavadi philosophers that inanimate matter, like nails and hair, comes from the living body is not a very sound argument. Nails and hair are undoubtedly inanimate, but they come not from the animate living being, but from the inanimate material body. Right? So matter is producing matter. Similarly, the argument that the scorpion comes from cow dung, meaning that a living entity comes from matter, is also unsound. The scorpion comes out of the cow dung is certainly a living entity, but the living entity has not come out of the cow dung. Only the living entity's material body, or the body of the scorpion, comes out of the cow dung. Right? So the jiva is not coming out. Jiva is, yeah. The sparks of the of the living entities, as we understand from the Bhagavad Gita, are injected into material nature, and then they come out. The body of the living entity in different forms is supplied by material nature, but the living entity himself is supplied by the Supreme Lord. Therefore, the spirit soul is not produced from matter. It takes on a particular type of body under a superior arrangement. According to our present experience, this material world is a combination of matter and spirit. The spirit is moving the matter. The spirit soul, the living entity, and matter are different energies of the Supreme Lord. And since both the energies are products of the Supreme Eternal, or its Supreme Truth, they are factual, not false. Because the living entity is part and parcel of the Supreme, he exists eternally. Therefore, for him, there cannot be any question of birth or death. So-called birth and death occur because of the material body. The Vedic version, Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma, means that since both the energies have emanated from the Supreme Brahman, everything we experience is non-different from Brahman. Right? It's non-different from, but it still doesn't mean it doesn't have its unique position. Otherwise, it would be the same thing. Okay? There are many means exactly the same. Does that make sense? Like you have the earth, and then you have the pot. They're one, but at the same time, is there two different? They're differently situated. Right? Because otherwise, if it's just earth, and you take some earth, I have some earth, and I take a bit of earth, and go here. Here's a pot. No, you go. That's earth. Right. But when it's made into a pot, now you can say it's a pot, though it's still earth. Yes?
I'm not quite sure. Is it the same experience or is it a different experience between the Jiva and Brahman?
Jiva and Brahman. Well, Brahman will be the supreme experience and we will be how much we experience. We're in connection with, but we'll never be. Does that make sense? Because that's what they're trying to say, is that our experience will be the same as Brahman.
But that's false.
Yeah. You can't, how can our 1/10,000, the tip of the hair, have the same experience as unlimited? Like Krishna is bliss. We experience bliss by being in touch with him. So depending upon our particular attraction to Krishna and that depth of that affection, then to that degree we taste that bliss. So that's why, you know, it's said that, you know, we will serve the internal potency. Right? Because the... That's Chechamechi. This is Chechamechi. You see, that's where it comes from, right? Huh? Nobody Bengali. Heard Chechamechi?
Yeah,
yeah. They're all right there, right? It's still.
This is a happy sound.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's all happening, you know. Krishna is unlimited, his Swarup Shakti is unlimited. Therefore, they are they're in quality and quantity, they have that equalness. Right? So the experience between them will be the greatest or unlimited. So then we can add to that. Does that make sense? So then we add a little bit. So it's, you're already having that unlimited perfect, but because everything emanating is also complete and perfect, we can add a little bit of perfectness. And so you have that unlimited, and we can add a touch to that. And this way we're in touch with the unlimited, but what we're experiencing will never be the same as what they're experiencing. So what Radha and Krishna are experiencing, we won't know. But we can know how much we're capable of. You can say, no, but why can't it be more? But no, it's like, how much current can go through a wire? You know, you connect it to something very big, and a great volume, it's connected, and so the full amount of currents that's actually possible to go through is going through. It's actually going through. But then, the point is so it's at its full capacity. So more than that doesn't have any meaning. And why is that full capacity there? Because it's in touch with the, you know, greater power of the electricity. Does that make sense? Yeah. So it's not that there's a problem. It's just that that's what our nature is. That's what we do. That's where we fit in. And so when we do what we're supposed to, then we're satisfied to the fullest degree that a living entity can be satisfied. And we serve those who are above us. Because it's through them that we know Krishna. There are many arguments about the existence of the material world, but the Vaishnava philosophical conclusion is the best. The example of the earthen pot is very suitable. The form of the earthen pot may be temporary, but it has a specific purpose. The purpose of the earthen pot is to carry water from one place to another. Similarly, this material body, although temporary, has a special use. The living entity is given a chance from the beginning of the creation to evolve different kinds of material bodies according to the reserved desires he has accumulated from time immemorial. The human form of body is a special chance in which the developed form of consciousness can be utilized. Right? So their point is it's temporary, it's useless. So they reject everything. So it appears that they're very renounced, but actually it's not actual renunciation, because they think it's theirs to renounce. While the Vaishnavas, that their renunciation is that the thing that's temporary, but it has a purpose. So it's used in the Lord's service for that purpose. So that's why we don't make up what you're supposed to do with something, right? We follow the you know, authority that this thing is used in this way, that thing in that way. And then it works out very nicely. Does that make sense? Because otherwise, then, if it's Krishna's energy, and he's made it for a specific purpose, and devotional service means pleasing him, wouldn't I use it in the way that pleases him? Right? So I'm going to use it in the way that pleases him for pleasing him. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yeah. Sometimes the Mayavadi philosophers push forward the argument that if this material world is truth, then why are householders advised to give up their connection with this material world and take sannyas? But the Vaishnava philosopher's view of sannyas is not that because the world is false, one must therefore give up material activities. The purpose of Vaishnava sannyas is to utilize things as they are intended to be utilized. Srila Rupa Goswami has given transcendentalists two formulas for dealing with the material world. When a Vaishnava renounces the material way of life and takes to sannyas, it is not on the conception of the falsity of the material world, but to devote himself fully to engaging everything in the service of the Lord. Srila Rupa Goswami therefore gives this formula. Quote, one should be unattached to the material world because material attachment is meaningless. The entire material world, the entire cosmic manifestation, belongs to God, Krishna. Therefore, everything should be utilized for Krishna, and the devotee should remain unattached to material things. This is the purpose of Vaishnava sannyas. A materialist sticks to the world of sense gratification. But a Vaishnava sannyasi, although not accepting anything for his personal sense gratification, knows the art of utilizing everything for the service of the Lord. Srila Rupa Goswami has therefore criticized the Mayavadi sannyasis with his second formula. Quote, because the Mayavadis do not know that everything has a utilization for the service of the Lord, they take the world to be false and falsely think they are liberated from the contamination of the material world. End quote. Since everything is an expansion of the energy of the Supreme Lord, the expansions are as real as the Supreme Lord is. Right? So they're real, even though they're temporary, and they're meant for a certain purpose, and that purpose is engaging in Krishna's service. Therefore, then, without attachment to sense gratification that you could gain from the engagement of these energies, you then engage them in the Lord's service. Right? Well, they think it's false, so they give it up, so then what's left? Right? Yeah, but at the same time, as they don't mind all, if it's all false, everything's false, they don't mind their position, their prestige, the benefits they get from that, they don't mind all that. The human body, or the material world, when used for sense gratification, is false. But if the human body and the material creation are used for the service of the Supreme Lord, their activities are never false. Right? So in other words, the world is real. The purposes of the world are real. Right? The engagements you can engage them in are real. Results are real. Because they're about Krishna. But if you don't use it for the service of the Lord, and then you use it for sense gratification, then that's false. Because it's not that the things you're using are false, it's your mentality is false. So therefore they take on that, the effect that they give you is false. Right? They'll give you that temporary result. But when you use it in the service of the Lord, even though it may be temporary, that having connected to the Lord, it gives you an eternal result. Therefore, it's not false, it's real. It is therefore confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita that even slightly using the body in the material world for the service of the Lord can deliver a person from the gravest danger. When properly utilized, neither the superior nor inferior energies emanated from the Supreme Personality of Godhead are false, right? When they're properly utilized. Otherwise, the effect is false because you have a false mentality. They're real, but the effect is going to be false. Is that what it is? As far as fruit of activities are concerned, they are mainly based on the platform of sense gratification. Therefore, an advanced Krishna conscious person does not take to them. Right? Persons who are not devotees take to the Vedic ritualistic ceremonies for materialistic reasons, and then they are bewildered. A vivid example may be given. An intelligent person possessing $1 million in currency notes does not hold the money without using it, even though he knows perfectly well that the currency notes in themselves are nothing but paper. When one has $1 million in currency notes, he is actually holding only a huge bunch of papers. But if he utilizes it for a purpose, then he benefits. You understand? It's just paper. So the material world is just the external energy, nothing special. It's unconscious matter, so it has actually no connection to us. It's real, but it's like the paper is real. But the point is then when you use this paper, in Krishna's service, then it takes on that, it gives the effect, that higher effect. Right? Just like the paper, when used for economic purposes, gives you the results there. But otherwise, it's just paper. Right? Similarly, although the material world may be false just like the paper, it has its proper beneficial utilization, right? Means it's not money. It's paper. But it's not that the paper's not exists. That the falseness is that we're taking it that this is money. So therefore, we use it for the Lord, and therefore we get that transcendental benefit. Because the currency notes, although paper, are issued by the government, they have full value. Similarly, this material world may be false or temporary, but because it is an emanation from the Supreme Lord, it has full value. The Vaishnava philosopher acknowledges the full value of this material world, and knows how to utilize it properly. Whereas the Mayavadi philosopher fails to do so, just as those who mistake a currency note for ordinary paper discard it and cannot utilize the money. Right? So they go, oh, it's just paper, and throw it away. Or the Vaishnav goes, it's just paper, but because it's emanated from the Lord, it can be used according to the direction of the Lord. Right? Therefore, even though it's paper, it's legal tender. So all the things of this material world emanate from the Lord, but when they're used to serve the Lord, that's the real purpose of it. Okay. Well. Srila Rupa Goswami therefore declares that if one rejects this material world as false, not considering the importance of this material world as a means to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead, such renunciation has very little value. A person who knows the intrinsic value of this world for the service of the Lord, who is not attached to the material world, and who renounces the world by not accepting it for sense gratification, is situated in real renunciation. This material world is an expansion of the material energy of the Lord. Therefore, it is real. It is not false, as sometimes concluded from the example of the snake and the rope. So then those two, I guess the one is, you know, always using everything in Krishna's service, and the other one is that one about, you know, the, how you say it? Yeah, it means that the renunciation is not complete. The Falgu Raja. Yeah, that Sarvapati Vinir Muktam, and then that Falgu. So these two are for them. Right? So what they should be doing, what we do, and then what they end up doing.
Bhagavad Gita, Krishna put these two shlokas together. Janma karma cha mai divyam, he tells first, by knowing his janma and karma, go to him. And after that, he tells Vita raga bhayaklora. He is free from this material desire, anger and bhaya. Fear and anger. Prabhupada in the purpose says that material attachment is raga.
And
bhaya is for impersonalist. And fear, anger is for voidist.
Voidist, yes.
So if all three is free from all these three things, then the saintly person has attained my abode.
Srila Sanatana Goswami writes, a series of blind men, people who do not know the meaning of scriptures, is created simply to carry on worldly functions. They are in error. The Vedas bewilder them, since they do not see the context of scriptural statements, because they are fixed on maintaining their own ideas. Though Saraswati appears in their hearts with much exchange, bharati, she bewilders them concerning the meaning of the words. The Vaishnavas know the conclusion of the scriptures. So even though these scholars, they study so much, they know so much, she comes, that they have that aspect of Saraswati, so they're able to study and know, but she bewilders them, so they actually don't know the real meaning of the words. They just put it together the way they feel it, and that way they argue with one another and keep themselves busy. The Shrutis support Satkaryavad. The Shrutis supporting Satkaryavad repeat what they previously said with logic and clarity. So, footnote 14. Those who utilize everything for the service of the Lord. The Satkaryavad doctrine means that the cause, Brahman, is present in the effect, the material world, and therefore the effect cannot be false. The Mayavadis, also known as Asatkaryavadis, maintain that the cause is not present in the effect because the effect does not exist at all. So then they don't exist, so why were we even talking, I guess?
So how then do they explain the Om Purnama Thapa Namanam? It's a very obvious kind of verse.
They probably stick to other Upanishads. You know, they'll just choose those verses that support what they say. As soon as you say that, then they'll say something else. Purna means this, and this means that, and you know, so that's why there are so many discussions about taking the direct meaning if it's applicable.
Yeah.
So because they'll always take these meanings that of these direct meanings like this and use an indirect meaning. Otherwise, how do they support impersonal when it's talking personal? Because they have to use an indirect meaning. Is that?
Yeah.
So wherever they can apply their meaning, they apply that. So that's the meaning of the word jugglies. You just change the meaning according to the grammar. You play with the words. And then you come up with your own meaning. Okay. So that's the thing. So they don't take the direct meanings. Unless it, you know, seems to support their Mayavad philosophy. Then they'll take it seemingly in the direct way. But their understanding's not complete. So that's the point. It's all things that emanate from Krishna are perfect and complete. So since Maya bodies aren't perfect and complete, then they don't emanate from the Lord. Therefore, they're illusion. They're false, according to their doctrine. Because they would have to emanate from the Lord to be factual. They don't emanate from the Lord from their own philosophy. Therefore, then they're false. The Shrutis continued, since this universe did not exist prior to its creation and will no longer exist after its annihilation, we conclude that in the interim it is nothing more than a manifestation imagined to be visible within you, whose spiritual enjoyment never changes. We liken this universe to the transformation. We liken this universe to the transformation of various material substances into diverse forms. Certainly those who believe that this figment of the imagination is substantially real are less intelligent. Srila Prabhupada writes in Krishna Bhava. The personified Vedas continued. The cosmic manifestation, because of the flickering nature of its impermanent existence, appears to less intelligent men to be false. The Mayavadi philosophers take advantage of the flickering nature of this cosmic manifestation to try to prove their thesis that this world is false. According to the Vedic version, therefore, the creation, this world, before the creation, I guess, of this world, before the creation, this world had no existence. And after dissolution, the world will no longer be manifested. Voidists also take advantage of this Vedic version and conclude that the cause of this material world is void. But the Vedic injunctions do not say that it is void. The Vedic injunctions define the source of creation and dissolution as yato va imani bhutani jayante. He from whom this cosmic manifestation has emanated and in whom, after annihilation, everything will merge. The same is explained in the Vedanta Sutra and the first verse of the first chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam by the words janmadyasya yataha. Srimad Bhagavatam 111. He from whom all things emanate. All these Vedic injunctions indicate that the cosmic manifestation is due to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that when it is dissolved, it merges into Him. The same principle is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. The cosmic manifestation comes into existence and again dissolves. And after dissolution, it merges into the existence of the Lord. This statement definitely confirms that the particular energy known as Bahiranga Maya, or the externally energy, although of flickering nature, is the energy of the Supreme Lord. And as such, it cannot be false. It simply appears false. Right? So then, they're talking about the imagined is substantially real, or less intelligent, means why? Because for sense gratification. Right? They're thinking it. Those who are... Yeah. So, who's less intelligent? It's not the devotees. It's those who take it to be not connected to the Lord. So, yeah, some examples. So, they take advantage, Prabhupada's point here is that these different schools take advantage of these kind of statements to try to establish this. But the previous statement was saying differently than that. Right? So we have to see this in context of that. Right? That there it's making the point that the Lord in His energy, so therefore it's real. Then people can be an illusion about what's there. Right? That's where those examples come from of the rope and snake. Snakes exist, ropes exist, but you are seeing it, the rope is the snake. That's illusion. But there is a real rope there, and real snakes exist, otherwise why would you mistake the rope for a snake? Right? Does that make sense? Yeah.
It seems that the difficulty to find that connection between the Lord and external energies, that connection, it's a remote connection, it's through His glance.
Yeah.
So it's a subtle thing. So I guess that's...
But that's why the acharyas is very important. Like you see is that here, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur is pointing out, supporting that this point of Sat Karyavad is being explained. And then Prabhupada is also explaining that that's what it is. But then in the verse, then you may or may not catch that. So that's what was the previous verse, is that you cannot understand and develop that love for Krishna without going through the acharyas. Because otherwise, we don't necessarily know how to use these things, or what they mean, or what level to take them. Because we see the Bhagavatam, the first verse, say that it's real and it's also unreal. You know, so then, how does that work? So, from this aspect, it's real. From that aspect, it's not. It exists, but what we think it is, or what we should gain from it in the way of enjoyment and happiness or whatever, that's false. Or to say it doesn't exist, that's illusion. Right? It exists, but it exists for a purpose, and that purpose is Krishna consciousness. So if the human form of life is used to fulfill that purpose, that now it's real. So someone who doesn't understand that is real, right, then that's less intelligent. Does that make sense? Or someone who takes the illusory aspect that we overlay on it and take that as real, that's less intelligent. So you have various ways you can be less intelligent. You know, so there's opportunity for everybody. The Shrutis continue. The illusory material nature attracts the minute living entity to embrace her, and as a result, he assumes forms composed of her qualities, right? The three modes. Subsequently, he loses all spiritual qualities and must undergo repeated deaths. You, however, avoid the material energy in the same way that a snake abandons its old skin. Glorious in your position of eight mystic perfections, you enjoy unlimited opulence. Footnote 15. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur assigns verse 38 to Bhagavad Arkamrita chapter 18, entitled The Perfection of the Mellow of Pure Love, The Glories of Rasa, Siddha Prema Rasa, Rasa Mahima, which is in the Prayojana section of the Thakur's book. So just as a note, because sometimes it appears very bewildering, the particular verses and where they're categorized. Yes. So, the Bhagavad Arkamrita, how it works, is it's taken all these verses from Bhagavatam, and that, you know, show this, you know, philosophical essence that's being given there, the Dasamul. But in, you know, 20, instead of 10 main subsections, it'll give 20. But they're all part of, they're just expansions of this 10, right? Which are expansions of Sambandha Abhideya and Prayojana, right? So you have Sambandha Abhideya and Prayojana that has 10 major divisions that also have some subdivisions. Right? And then within that, then you'll have, even you take Krishna's energies, and you'll have subdivisions of, you know, the internal potency, the external, the jivas, and all the different things like that. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now all these verses that establish all this Siddhanta are all brought together. I think there's about 1,300 verses. Like that. So now, Bhaktivinoda Thakur then will weave them together. It's not that he just puts them in. It's not just a shloka book. But he'll put them there in the order that by you reading one section from beginning to end, it reads as an explanation. Does that make sense? So in the context of the book, the verse, then you'll see the natural, how it's flowing. And how he's expanding on different things and showing different details and everything like that. And keeping this very nice flow. Then it makes sense. Why not?
How is
the glories of rasa. See, that's the whole point, is they can see things that we don't. We're just looking at the words. Okay. Means the Lord, does he interact with his external potency?
Mm-hmm.
Only with the internal potency. Why? Okay, why not? But what's the benefit of interacting?
Pleasure.
And pleasure is coming because of the exchange of?
Love.
And that love also is known as?
Prema.
And another word is?
Service.
That exchange?
Service.
Rasa. Yes. Therefore, the perfection of the mellow of pure love.
Okay.
So, in other words,
each and every verse can be suitable for them.
No, means that's why we follow them. They can see that. We're looking at this technical verse, philosophical verse, and they're seeing prema. That's why we have to approach through the acharyas. So, we're learning these knowledge now, and then you keep reading this, and at some point in your life, you will also see like that. But we're studying now to learn the principles, the foundations, and everything, the fundamentals. And then by that practice of Krishna consciousness, and that, then we'll also be able to see like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So then, now it's just like, what's this got to do with it? Later on, they go, wow, okay, yeah. You know, then instead of the prayers, the personified Vedas, this being this philosophical kind of thing, it's all these wonderful things about Krishna and his glories.
And some work light on that specific one.
But we just gave. We didn't just say something?
Yeah.
See, Bhaktivinoda Thakur points out you cannot explain taste. You can only explain what is tasted. Does that make sense? I can tell you it was nice. It was a really great lunch. But I can't tell you the taste itself. So therefore the acharyas, they can only point out what's there. And then as with our qualification, then one day we'll be able to taste it also.
So we get a low mark because we didn't taste it yet.
Yes.
Yes.
Sorry?
It's very difficult to understand because the first three lines speak of the jiva.
The first three lines speak of the jiva.
Embracing the material energy.
Okay.
And the second speaks about the Lord who is not interacting with the material energy at all.
Right. So therefore, what does he interact with?
The internal potency.
Okay. So we have jiva, internal potency,
yes,
and the Supreme Lord. So isn't that not the makings of a Mahavakya? Right? Om is A, Krishna, U, then the internal potency, M, the living entities. Right? And then we have the Chandra Bindu. The Chandra is his Dham, and the Bindu is his pastimes. That's
Om. How
did
we get into that one from here?
You saw?
I got it.
What?
That reminds me of that one where, what is it? I think it's Mel Brooks comes in on the as a waiter for the what do you call it? The Last Supper. You know, he's a waiter at whatever it is. They plays like a restaurant, and he goes something about, you know, what do you guys want? Oh, they're busy and all that. And then he goes, he's upset. So he goes, Jesus, you know. And then Jesus says, what? You know, and then he turns in and says, you know, no, what do you want? Then he keeps going and keep going back and forth like that. So.
The explanation that you gave about Om for this particular verse, can it not apply to other verses also and many verses and practically all the verses?
Yes, that's why Om is the only Mahavakya in the Vedic literature. Not Tatvamasi, not you are that, and this I am, you know, I, but I am you, you are me, and we are all together. Not, none of that kind of jazz.
No?
No, no, somehow or another. They seem to have missed that. Well, no. Because that means, why would Om be that? Because all verses are seen in the context of this. No?
Why the rasa and the mood?
Sorry?
Speaking of rasa and then...
Speaking of rasa, so there's no rasa going on between the Lord, the internal potency, and the living entity in their dom, in their pastimes. It's just the regular day-to-day grind and all that kind of stuff like that, you know. Getting stuck in traffic, taking out 900,000 cows, and then all the other cowherd boys have all their cows, and the traffic is just, like, really terrible and all that. That's why they have to take a lunch with them, because they even have to stop, sit down, and eat, because there's just so much cows and this and that that they can't even hardly get out of, you know, Vrindavan. Okay, very good.
Temporary
interpretation. Yes.
Shall we move on? What is in all? U is internal energy.
U is internal energy.
U is internal energy. M is living energy. Right, because our connection to the Lord is through. Yeah. So.
Then Maharaj, from the point of view of Krishna, everything is collision only.
Everything is?
Pravijana.
Means that's the ultimate point, because the thing is you have Jnana, Kriya, and Icha. Mm-hmm. You have Satchit and Ananda. So he has all these aspects. That's the point. Everything's there. So that's why, depending upon what's there, different aspects are brought out. Mm-hmm. That's why Om is the central point. Then all verses are expanding from that. And they may be describing many, and you know, so many varieties of the unlimited glories of the Lord. Mm-hmm. You're at the top of 47? Okay. So we good?
Well, the next one.
Huh?
To the next one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as we go, it'll become easier and easier.
Yeah, for what then, for a while?
Hmm?
They were non-existent for a while.
Yeah, because it's just certain verses he's taking. Because he's only included, like I said, about 1,300 out of the 18,000. You know. Because he's not telling the story that's there and the whole discussions and all the details. He's just that essential point from there. Then from that you can understand all the other aspects. Right. Yeah. So when these start making sense, then you know, okay, now we're really getting something. Yeah, yeah. So it's the way that it's you could say your test. Yeah, the litmus test. Just be happy it's not one of the questions.
So what is Bhakti Vinod Thakur mean?
Yeah.
I'm not clear. What's the purpose of that book?
Yeah, same question. What's the purpose of the book?
Purpose of which book?
Bhagavad Gita.
Didn't I just explain it? Did I just explain it? You didn't hear? Or? No, it means that it's about what is the essence of the philosophy that's being given, because Srimad Bhagavatam, it being the... the ripened fruit, right? So it's explaining pure love for Krishna and that devotional service for him. That wasn't explained directly in any of the other Vedic literatures that he compiled. So in Bhagavatam, it's directly explained. So then Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhagavad Akramichamala is giving the essence of that, on how the Bhagavatam, what exactly is being explained. Right? It's at the ascension in those 10 truths given by Lord Chaitanya. Right? And then some of them he's giving subdivision because there's such, you know, serious subject matter, they may have other aspects to them. You know, it's like devotional service is the one, but what's favorable, what's unfavorable, what would be their practices, what be, so he breaks it down into that, but it's actually still only 10 topics. So then he's just giving the how Bhagavatam's explaining these 10 topics, which are the essence of all philosophy. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But the form of it, because generally it's thought of just as a shloka book, but it's not. It's the verses are put in order, because it's not that the verses are necessarily in the order that they are in the Bhagavatam. It's not he started from first canto and went to 12th and then picked some ones and then kept them like that. He's moved them so that they fit into the categories and that they explain themselves one after another. So technically you don't really need purports. They're self-explanatory. It's like Prabhupada did Gita Gan. That makes sense? How he translated, it's its own explanation.
Can you say it is thematic?
It's a thematic study. But my point is that even within a section, let's say the section has 20 Bhagavatam verses, those verses are put in an order, so that section is explained just by reading through the verses. Not that you take each one and, okay, yeah, like this, maybe this. It's an explanation itself by the run of in the order that he puts the verses in. So the difficulty here is you don't see the context of the other verses around this. That's why it's more difficult. That's what I was trying to explain. Is that?
Hmm?
Okay. So therefore, you know, we try our best to catch it, because they read through it, they see this. But for us, when we just read all of these verses in their natural order, then it will make more sense. Right? But at the same time, unless we studied all this, we still won't make that. We won't get that much from it. So when we finish Srimad Bhagavatam, we'll try to get time to go through it. Then it will make some sense. Okay? Then we can test it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just read through it and like that. Okay. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.